It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about the Open Government Traveling Show, which kicks off in Wisconsin cities today. First, Wisconsin state senators are making their final votes of the year today, ending their two-year session. Lawmakers are scheduled to take up over 80 bills, including plans to allow online voter registration and a package of bills aimed at tackling opioid abuse in Wisconsin. Laurel White joins us from the state capitol now to talk about the bills on the schedule today and some of the more notable omissions from the schedule, too. She's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
So to start off with now, if these bills that are before the Senate today are passed, does that mean that their next stop is Governor Walker's desk?
Yeah, for the most part. To my knowledge, the governor hasn't voiced any opposition to any of the bills that are going before the Senate today that have already passed the assembly. So you, of course, never know what's going to happen. But it's expected that if these bills pass the Senate today, they're headed to Governor Walker.
Well, let's run down some of the higher profile bills on the docket, starting with this is one that's been a little more contentious, a bill that would loosen regulations on high capacity wells.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that bill, basically what it does is that it loosens the regulations on these wells, which high capacity wells can pump about 100,000 gallons of water per day. And they're used by agricultural businesses primarily. And so what this bill does is that it allows people to either construct a new well or repair a well in the same place where a well already exists. And it also allows people to transfer a permit on a well if they sell their property. So opponents are kind of concerned because they see this as permitting wells in perpetuity and people not having to reapply for things. Proponents say that it's making things more stable for businesses. They don't have to worry about their permit being yanked somewhere down the line because they're obviously investing a lot of money in these wells. There's something kind of crazy happening with this bill, though, and you mentioned some of the controversy. Yesterday, a Senate committee actually made some small changes to their version of the bill. So, right. So the assembly would have to come back and approve that change if the bill were to head to Governor Walker, unless the Senate decided to take up the assembly version of the bill today, which doesn't have those Senate changes. If they did that, then that bill could go to the governor. So this proposal is really up in the air right now.
Right. So given those wrinkles, it sounds like it's anybody's guess what could ultimately happen today.
Exactly.
Well, another one we should look at, the ban on plastic bag bans. It sounds confusing, but essentially this one is about making it against the law for municipalities to ban plastic bags. Where is that?
Yeah. So this bill, has passed the assembly already. So the Senate will be taking it up today. Essentially, what it does is what you said before. So it would prevent local governments, counties, cities, towns from banning plastic bags. And as you may know, some communities around the country have already done this. Proponents of plastic bag bans say that they're good for the environment. You don't have all that plastic rolling around. Cities like Chicago have done this. The state of California actually has a plastic bag ban. What's kind of interesting about this proposal, Veronica, is that there aren't a lot of cities and towns in Wisconsin, to our knowledge, that have plastic bag bans. So proponents of the bill are saying this is a good thing for business. Having different policies in different towns regarding plastic bag bans can be confusing for customers. This allows businesses to provide what customers want. But opponents to the bill are saying this isn't even happening in Wisconsin. People aren't banning plastic bags. This is just legislators sort of listening to the concerns of businesses based on what's happening in other states. So this is seen by some as a really preemptive measure in the state of Wisconsin if it were to pass the Senate today.
And to take a look at another one, online voter registration. This is another one that has had a fair bit of debate surrounding it. So what's the status of that one?
There has been a lot of debate about this bill. So essentially what this bill does is that if you have a state-issued driver's license or an ID card, you could register online to vote. And that would be starting in the spring 2017 primary election. So a little ways down the road here. Opponents to this bill aren't concerned about that part, really. What they're primarily concerned about is the fact that the bill also eliminates the existence of special registration deputies. And special registration deputies are volunteers that complete a government training course, and they go out and they're empowered to register people to vote. So what opponents are saying is that if these special registration deputies are eliminated, it's basically going to shut down voter registration drives in the state. And those voter registration drives are what traditionally serve people who don't have ready access to the internet or might not have a state-issued driver's license. So those communities might not be served. That's what opponents to the bill are saying.
We're talking with Laurel White right now, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, and she's talking about the final session of the Wisconsin Senate, which is wrapping up today. Now, we should talk about the college affordability package from Governor Walker. I understand some of his bills made it into the Senate, some didn't. Let's start with the ones that did.
Yeah, so Governor Walker has been talking about this college affordability package for months now. It was a big piece of his State of the State address. He said that this proposal would really help Wisconsin students and afford college. So there are six bills in this plan, and only four of them are scheduled to be taken up by the Senate today. And what those four bills do, and they do a lot, is they provide emergency and need-based grants for technical college students in the state. They also create internship coordinator positions, just two of those positions under the Department of Workforce Development in the state. And then they also require schools to update students yearly on the status of their debt and how much school is costing them.
And so looking at the things, again, which didn't make it, what's the significance of what's not there?
So what's interesting about what's not there, Veronica, is that the most expensive and some would say the most impactful part of the plan has been left off by the Senate. So that particular bill was estimated to cost about $5 million, and that's why it has been left off. Legislative leaders agreed a couple months ago that they wanted to keep spending for this part of the legislative session under $20 million. So this particular bill was expensive, and they decided to forego it. So here's what the bill would have done if senators were to take it up today. Basically, what it would do is eliminate a cap on student loan interest deductions. The cap is currently $2,500, so that cap would be eliminated. And as I said, that was expected to cost the state about $5 million, and legislators just thought that was a bit too much.
And moving on to another bill that did not make it, this one very contentious in the state of Wisconsin, sanctuary cities.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a bill that brought quite a few protesters to the state capitol last month. I'm sure you remember. There were thousands of people here protesting that bill. And what that bill would have done if the Senate were to take it up today, it has already been passed by the Assembly, would be to financially penalize cities in the state of Wisconsin that have so-called sanctuary city policies, which are essentially policies that ban law enforcement officials from asking people about their immigration status after they're arrested. So if cities were to be found to be enforcing these kind of policies, basically their funding would be cut off. And opponents said that this would create quite a bit of fear in the immigrant community. People would be less likely to report crimes like domestic abuse if they were afraid that individuals might be deported when law enforcement were to become involved.
And Laurel, as we wrap up, just briefly, anything else that's on your highlight to watch list and what you're looking forward to for the future?
Well, there's a lot going on today, Veronica, and we never know what's going to happen. We're expecting a really late night. They're also going to be taking up some bills, we expect them to anyway, that would create underage drinking amnesty. So amnesty from underage drinking tickets if you were to report a sexual assault. There are also some changes to how drunken driving offenders would be forced to, cooperate with law enforcement after their conviction.
So a lot to watch there. Laurel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That was Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, with us to talk about the final session of the Wisconsin Senate wrapping up today. Coming up, we'll talk to a journalist about the Open Government Traveling Show, a tour that kicks off today in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Sunshine Week, a national celebration of access to public information. In Wisconsin, journalists from different areas are joining a three-day, eight-city informational tour focusing on how to use the state's open records laws. Mark Pitch is with us now to talk about this tour called the Open Government Traveling Show. He's the assistant city editor for the Wisconsin State Journal and president of the Madison chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, how would you describe what the Open Government Traveling Show is?
We're a group of journalists and open government advocates who have gotten together to make a tour of eight cities in Wisconsin to promote the state's open records law and to help average citizens understand what it is and how to use it.
And open records have been in the news a lot in the last year here in Wisconsin. Is there anything particular about the timing of this? We know it's Sunshine Week, but is there anything more to it?
Well, no. Sunshine Week seemed to be a very good time to conduct this effort. Sunshine Week is a national celebration of open government. Our chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists always tries to do something fun or important during Sunshine Week, and after what happened over the July 4th weekend last year when the governor and the legislature tried to gut the state's open records law, you know, we felt it was very important to continue to tell people why this law means so much for Wisconsin, and to help people to remain vigilant. I mean, one of the really amazing things that came out of the that weekend was how much average people stepped up and contacted their lawmaker. The governor himself received about 400 emails over the July 4th weekend. That's what people did rather than, you know, or in addition to having barbecues, going to parades, visiting loved ones. It really was an organic effort. And these, you know, it wasn't just journalists, it wasn't just open government advocates. It was average folks all around Wisconsin coming together and saying that this was not the kind of legislation that we needed to enact in our state.
Now, you are journalists putting on this open government traveling show, but it sounds as though you're targeting ordinary people, average citizens. Why ordinary people?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is, like I said, we wanted to sort of keep up the vigilance. But the truth of the matter is that while journalists may get more attention for their use of the open records law, average citizens by far use the law more than folks like me in my job. We have our companies behind us. We sometimes have the ability to go out and hire lawyers, but it's really your neighbors who are using the records law more often than we are. And, you know, it's not just state government either. It's, you know, your local school board, your local city council, and any other public body. So really, you know, the folks who live next door to you are the ones that are using it the most often.
And what is the benefit, do you think, about knowing these laws, knowing how to use them to the average citizen?
We're in a democratic republic. It's incredibly vital for us to be able to understand how our government works, how the people that we elect are working on our behalf. They're using your tax dollars and my tax dollars to enact laws. And if they enact a law that we support or that if they enact a law that we oppose, we ought to be able to find out how they arrived at the decision to write those laws. Sometimes people who have a lot of money to hire lobbyists or, you know, companies or advocacy groups have more influence in government than an average citizen does. What the open records law allows us to do, at least on the state level, is to find out who are those people who are trying to influence government. It doesn't mean that the state legislature or the lawmakers are going to make different choices, but at least, again, in our open democratic republic, we can find out who is influencing.
We're talking with Mark Pitch right now, president of the Madison chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, talking about the Open Government Traveling Show, which is going on this week, focusing on open records laws. And your show, I understand, features a tutorial on just what the records laws are and how they can be used. And I wonder if you could walk us through a couple key examples.
We're going to be telling people, you know, how does the law work, what you're entitled to get under the law, and what you're, what lawmakers can hold back from you, because there are some exemptions, i.e., you know, personal information of people who write the lawmakers, for example. We're going to talk to them about certain cases that have had influence in determining when state and local governments have to respond to records, and we're going to have a advocacy groups from both the left and the right sharing examples of how they themselves use the law. That's another one of the sort of remarkable things about what happened on July 4th, is it wasn't just people on one side of the political aisle or the other who raised questions about these changes. It was a very sort of bipartisan opposition.
And are there surprises, do you think, that the average citizen will hear when they go to see this, if they go to see this, about the open records law that maybe they didn't know?
Well, we hope that people who come to our events will leave with a better understanding of how they're going to use, how they can use the law, and in what circumstances they'll find it beneficial. It may be a surprise for them to learn that, that folks from both sides of the aisle find that that open and transparent government is important. You know, liberals have a certain idea of why it's important. Conservatives have a certain idea of why it's important. But everybody's coming together to tell the residents of the state that this is something that's fundamental to our democracy.
And there is some debate still in Wisconsin about open records laws, just as far as whether, for instance, drafting should be on the record, should have to be submitted in an open records request. What do you think some of the big debates are still to come about open records?
One of the things that we thought might happen would be a legislative council study of the records law. It appears that that may not happen, but there might be two areas that we'll be on the lookout for. One is to enact language that would allow for a quote-unquote deliberative process that refers to the sort of exchange of communications among lawmakers or among staff members of lawmakers and legislators themselves, in which they discuss how to write laws. That kind of thing is valuable because we get to see sort of the origins of the lawmaking process. We can also find through those communications who or what was trying to influence legislation. So a deliberative process is one area where there might be some continued action. And in fact, the governor is currently engaged in a lawsuit because he's invoked this deliberative process privilege, even though it doesn't exist in law. The other area that we are watching for is there seems to be some bipartisan desire to remove the names of people who contact legislators in regard to a particular public policy issue. That would prevent those of us who use the records law from finding out who is trying to influence the legislators. The argument that they've made is that, you know, the public, when you write an email to a lawmaker on a particular topic, doesn't want their name to be disclosed. We've found exactly the opposite, that people expect that when they write to their lawmaker, that that's public, and they want their views known. The people, you know, what really the lawmakers are trying to do is prevent us from finding out that, you know, lobbyist X, Y, and Z, or interest group X, Y, and Z is really asking for a piece of legislation.
Now, as you mentioned last summer, lawmakers tried to change open records laws in Wisconsin, but they walked that back after a huge public response. How would you say Wisconsin is faring now when it comes to transparent government and open records?
We've got to give Governor Walker a lot of credit for the executive order that he issued on Friday. In that order, he outlined a number of steps that he's requiring his administration to take to do a better job in responding to open records requests. In general, there is it has been an increasing challenge from local government to state government, from school board to the legislature, to get records provided in a timely manner. And we're constantly fighting battles. But hopefully this executive order on the governor's part will influence other government entities.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate your time.
That was Mark Pitch, president of the Madison chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, joining us to talk about the Open Government Traveling Show, which kicks off today in cities across Wisconsin. Coming up, our guest looks at how trade issues could have an impact on the Wisconsin primary. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. The influence of Scott Walker continues to be felt in next month's race for Milwaukee County Executive. Incumbent Chris Abele and challenger Chris Larson are battling over whether it's good to get along with the Republican governor. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Governor Walker was Milwaukee County Executive from 2002 to 2010. He remains popular in conservative areas of the county, but not so in most of the city of Milwaukee and a few suburbs. During this year's county executive primary, Chris Larson, a Democratic state senator from Milwaukee, often criticized Chris Abele for working with Walker and Republican legislators during Abele's 6 years in office. That message may have helped Larson narrowly top Abele in the February race. Since then, Abele, also a Democrat in this nonpartisan contest, has gone to the airwaves trying to link Larson to Walker.
Larson turned his back on his party and voted with Scott Walker to give special treatment to Wall Street and the wealthy.
That ad about Larson's legislative vote on a credit card bill quickly became controversial. The Abele campaign says the commercial is true, but Larson says the Wall Street claim isn't.
We're here to talk about the desperate attack ad Chris Abele has out against me, trying to associate me with Scott Walker.
Larson held a news conference asking Abele to take down the ad. The state lawmaker says the bill didn't help Wall Street, but did help a local community activist and Larson donor. Larson says he didn't know the man worked for a Wisconsin bank. The same day,
we've definitely been adding more employers.
There are quite a few.
County Executive Abele came by a job fair for veterans. Just as Governor Walker promotes hiring of vets, Abele says he's stepped up local efforts to boost employment of veterans. But Abele also tried to put some distance between himself and Walker, dating back to 2002.
When Scott Walker ran for county executive the first time, I supported Jim Ryan. And after that, I supported David Reamer. And after that, I supported Lena Taylor. And when he ran for governor, I supported Tom Barrett. And when he ran again, I supported Tom Barrett. And then I supported Mary Burke. And until recently, I was the state agent for Martin O'Malley for president.
Abele also says he's no Scott Walker on many issues.
You know, I'm pro-choice, pro-gay rights, pro-rational gun control, pro-same-day registration. I put millions more into child support.
But the argument between Abele and Larson over Governor Walker may continue until the April 5th election. During a televised debate, Larson explained his plan to increase the Milwaukee County sales tax by 1% to pay for deferred maintenance in county parks and for transit. Larson says some other counties want the same thing.
Because under Walker's leadership and the Republicans, they have cut off local funding and local control across the state. And so many of the counties, the majority of the counties, have utilized the sales tax available to them, and they're starving for new revenue.
Larson says he would reduce property taxes with some of the sales tax revenue. But County Executive Abley says the governor and Republican-controlled legislature would block Milwaukee County from raising the sales tax over a current state cap. Abley says there are other ways to fix parks and fund transit, mainly by paying down county debt and reducing interest payments.
But in the meantime, I'm not simply going to say I'm angry at the people who are the cause of this and just kind of anger my way through it. I'm going to use the tools I have.
Abley is wealthy and is expected to boost his spending in the final weeks of the campaign, while public sector unions and progressive groups are trying to help Larson. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The 2016 presidential campaign has focused on a number of issues like national security, economic inequality, and immigration. But one issue that hasn't grabbed as many headlines is trade. But this issue is picking up steam, especially with a recent video circulating online that shows Indiana workers learning the company that they work for is moving their jobs to Mexico.
It became clear that the best way to stay competitive and protect the business for long term is to move production from our facility in Indianapolis to Monterrey, Mexico.
Donald Trump has been promoting this video in his campaign, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel editorial board recently wrote a piece pointing out that opposing trade deals is a major part of the appeal for candidates like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Both candidates have loudly opposed trade agreements for hurting American jobs. But what is a good trade policy, and how much does this issue affect voters who they decide to support? Joining us now is Steve Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Steve, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thank you.
So is there common ground when it comes to Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders when it comes to trade agreements?
Well, there is. It's economists have been arguing for years that opening up trade agreements, opening up markets is actually good for the economy in the long term. But it comes with some short-term painful adjustments. And I think that the current political environment right now is that you have very much of a populist type argument that is essentially telling people what they want to hear, regardless of what the actual facts are.
So you mentioned some short-term painful adjustments. What are they, and are we seeing those right now?
We have been. We've been seeing them for a long time now. Almost 30 years we've been seeing these kind of adjustments. But you have to realize that if a company wants to pick up and move production to Mexico or Taiwan or Vietnam, they could do that with or without trade agreements. Essentially what the trade agreements are doing is essentially trying to establish the rules of the game, what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, and to essentially try to allow competitive markets to work a little bit more efficiently.
Some economists have said that free trade was intended to be the rising tide that lifts all boats, good for companies, good for the United States, good for workers, but that when everything comes out in the wash, it's possible to grow free trade and the amount that's being exported, but not helping workers so much when it comes to the bottom line, their salaries.
Well, it depends on who you're asking. If you look at Mexico, for example, after NAFTA went into place, there's been a noticeable jump in economic growth in Mexico. U.S., there's a little bit of growth attached to NAFTA, but the real benefits in the short term have been a lot of our trading partners. And this has essentially, so it's rising boats, but we're not quite yet in that lake yet.
So how long does it take for something like that to play out in terms of the benefits seeing in all tiers?
Well, I mean, you're seeing it in some sectors. I mean, there are some sectors in Wisconsin, for example, that are actually able to benefit from these opening up of the markets. Dairy, for example, we're seeing an increase in exports from dairy into international markets, and it's partially because some of these trade barriers are coming down. In Wisconsin, we also, some of the biggest exporting sectors are medical equipment. And again, a lot of that is because of declining trade barriers. You have to realize, though, that the U.S. economy still, only about 13% of the U.S. economy is related to international trade. This compares to 30% for Canada, or 40% to 50% for Germany, or 30% for the U.K. So the U.S. economy is still very much driven by domestic production.
Now, Wisconsin has lost about 30,000 manufacturing jobs over the past decade. Of course, the Great Recession is part of this picture, but can we put down any of that loss to the global trade climate?
Some of it has been, but again, a company that is looking at reducing its costs, they are going to move whether these trade agreements are here or not. That's irrelevant. A company that is looking at significantly reducing labor cost, or perhaps making new investments in new factories, they're finding that the cost benefits are such that, you know, moving into these other countries is more profitable for them.
We opened with that clip, a real clip, a documentary clip of workers in Indianapolis being told that their plant is going to be shuttering, moving operations to Monterrey, Mexico. You heard the response from the workers there. What would you say to those workers as an economist to help them, as you see it? I realize there's no single answer here, but what do you want them to know about why this is happening?
Well, as a cold-hearted economist, I would say the markets are difficult. You know, the markets don't take, doesn't take prisoners. You know, the thing is that the manufacturing base in the U.S. is shifting. We're shifting away from low-skilled, commodity-based type markets. We simply cannot compete in those markets, and we haven't been able to for 30, 40 years. But where we can compete is in customized high-end products. That's where we compete. And we do very well, thank you very much. And you're actually seeing some of these high-end manufacturers that are actually went overseas, and now they're coming back. They're coming back because the quality of the workforce is better here. And so there are winners and losers. But pointing to free trade agreements and essentially the rules of how trade takes place is not driving a lot of these decisions by companies.
We're talking right now with economist Steve Deller, talking about the role trade will play in this year's presidential election, looking at Wisconsin and beyond, and in general, taking in the factors affecting trade and what we're hearing from presidential candidates. And we want to hear from you. Is a candidate's trade plan a major reason that you would vote for someone? Do you maybe like Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders' ideas for getting rid of trade agreements? Have you been affected in your work life by trade agreements in the past? Call 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation now about how presidential candidates like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are voicing their opposition to trade agreements and getting some traction with that position, too. You can join the conversation. Is a candidate's trade plan a major reason you might vote for someone in this election? Do you like Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders' ideas better? They both want to get rid of trade agreements. Are there nuances there that you see? And do you think the trade agreements in place now have helped or hurt American workers? Call 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with UW-Madison economist Steve Deller. And let's take a first call now. We've got John on the line in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
Good. Thanks for having me on. I just want to make the comment that I don't know if it's completely connected, but I know my dad works for Johnson Controls. I think he's been there for about 14 years, and they just got let known that their department's going over to Bratislava. So I know that's not in the same sense as a lot of people think, you know, Mexico, Vietnam, places like that, but I know there is that a lot of jobs moving over to Eastern Europe like that. So whether it's trade or whether it's tax benefits, the same way that Johnson Controls hooked up with Tyco and now they're moving to Ireland, I think it's all interwoven, so maybe there might not be a clear cut. Yes, it's trade. Yes, it's taxes, but I think it is kind of a partnered issue. And I'll take my response off the phone. Thank you.
John, appreciate that call. Thanks for sharing that story about your father. Father worked at Johnson Controls, now being found the plant's moving to operations to Bratislava. Are there forces here, Steve, that are working in concert that are affecting some of these changes we're seeing?
It's the tax issue is a fairly important one. I do a fair amount of work looking at how firms relocate within the U.S. And within the U.S., taxes really don't matter anything. But when you start taking an international view, then taxes actually do start to play a role. You see a number of companies that are moving to Ireland because of the way the Ireland taxes corporations and businesses there that they don't. And at that kind of a degree, it can make a big difference. With Johnson Control, I don't know the details of why they're doing that, but one of the things that is happening that that John brought up is that a lot of these companies are multinational corporations. And you have a corporate headquarters that may be sitting in Switzerland. And when they're making a decision to pick up a plant from the U.S. and move it to Eastern Europe or something like that, it's the same as a national corporation in the U.S. decided to move a plant from Wisconsin to Oklahoma. It's just simply they're moving pieces around on a chessboard. But when you have multinational corporations, the chessboard is the entire world. So they're making business decisions and trade agreements, per se, if anything, really have a very minor role in that.
So what are the prevailing forces when you look at situations like that?
A lot of it is you have to realize that a lot of other countries are much more open in terms of their, not so much in terms of their trade agreements, but in terms of the amount of money that are flowing in and out of other countries. So when we start talking about putting up trade barriers, these other countries are basically saying, look, we live in a very large open economy, and that's the new reality of things. And that's essentially the new market economy, and we need to be able to compete in that kind of market economy.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, and we'll go next to Dave. Dave is joining us from Lake Villa, Illinois. Dave, hello.
Hello. Yes, about, 6-7 years ago, I was on a vacation with my wife in Huatuco, Mexico, and I was speaking with a local gentleman, and he informed me that their biggest import or export from Huatuco was one out of five of their sons is coming to the United States to work, and he said the problem being was when they passed the NAFTA agreement, the local farmer couldn't compete with the price of the cheap corn coming from the United States. So I think these agreements affect everybody.
Dave, appreciate your thoughts there and your story. Do these trade agreements end up hurting the little guy?
They can. I mean, there is... trade economists had always talked about trade is driven by what economists call comparative advantage. We have a better technology or better resources that we can make something more cost effectively than, say, our competitors. That's our comparative advantage. They're also talking about now what economies of scale or economies of size is that being bigger does drive down cost. So when you're looking at a corn farmer in the U.S. that's got 3,000 acres, their cost advantage is so much higher than a small farmer that's only got 40 acres. They just simply can't compete. So the idea then is that they need to find markets that they can compete in, and they need to be able to adjust.
And what would those markets look like?
One of the things that's shifting into now is moving away from commodities to products. And these are... things that you can actually attach a little bit more of a price to. For example, I'd be willing to pay a little bit more for a particular type of fruit because I know that it's unique. It's different. It's not mass-produced. So it's moving into that kind of a market.
We're talking with UW-Madison economist Steve Deller right now, talking about trade agreements and how they may factor into thinking about the presidential election, too. And we're going to go next to Barbara in Waupaca. Barbara, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, because my concern is the trade courts that would be part of these agreements and how these trade courts would affect big corporations' ability to evade national laws, especially like concerning environmental regulations and things like that. Can you explain the trade courts?
Barbara, appreciate the call. Steve, trade courts.
Very complicated issue, but what happens with a lot of these trade agreements is that it's not just simply removing trade barriers. It's also implementing certain types of worker protections. It's imposing certain types of environmental regulations. So essentially what we're saying is that, okay, country X, we will open up a trade agreement with you. We will lower barriers. We want to promote this, but you need to clean up some things. You need to clean up some of your labor laws. You need to clean up some of your environmental laws. And will they come up to the U.S. standard? Probably not, but at least they're moving in the right direction. So the trade agreements are actually used as a mechanism to get some of these developing countries to actually kind of, you know, move the needle a little bit on things like environmental. Now, are the environmental regulations in these developing countries going to be as strong as the U.S.? No. Will companies take advantage of that? Probably. But it's moving the needle in the right direction.
And Steve, taking it back to the presidential election, Donald Trump has said that he'd like to impose high tariffs on Chinese and Mexican imports. As an economist, how do you think that would impact the United States economy and taking it back here maybe to Wisconsin, too?
I think it'd be a disaster for two reasons. One, you would see prices in U.S. stores go through the roof. You would see the export market for a lot of our goods drop like a rock. The only thing that is keeping the U.S. auto industry growing strong is exports to China. And we would essentially cut that off. We would be shooting Michigan in the foot if we did something like that. The other thing, and this is a longer term, is that when you start to put up these trade barriers, what happens is the industries that are protected tend to get a little, I'm debating on using this term, they tend to get fat and lazy. And they're not facing competition. So if they're not facing competition, why be efficient? Why innovate? Innovate drives the economy. Innovation drives the economy. So putting up trade barriers essentially is putting dampers on competition, which harms the economy.
We leave it there. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
That was Steve Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us there to talk about the importance of trade policies in this year's presidential election and beyond. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we check out the latest results from this week's primaries and find out what they mean for the tightening presidential race. Central Time's political correspondent Harry Enten joins us with the latest. Our guest will explore the friction between local control and legal oversight from the state legislature. And as a new ad campaign focuses on Wisconsin supper clubs gets underway, we're going to ask you, what would you highlight in an ad about Wisconsin? That's all coming up right here on Central Time tomorrow.